Today is August the 16th, 1984. Vera Hickman interviewing Margaret Blair.
Now you can ask.
Margaret, you were just ready to, the new highway was coming through and you had had to leave the house that you had been in.
Yes.
And you went to a new house, and did you take the furniture business with you?
Oh yes, of course, we moved the whole furniture. But before I tell you about that, I think I should tell you about something I forgot to tell you before. That was about our second trip for a new tourist card. And the reason I think it's important is because we went to Guatemala, and our experience there is so connected with the slaughter, which is still taking place and has been taking place ever since in Guatemala. You know, there are now hundreds of thousands of Guatemalan refugees in Mexico. Anyway, we started our second trip, that was back in 1956, in September, during the rainy season. And every day it was wet, wet, wet. We went by bus and train, where we were robbed, to the border town, where a roof leaked all night.
And you were robbed on the train?
Yes.
The train was held up?
No. Just
that big. Okay.
And when we got to the border town, whose name I've forgotten, we took a taxi. After we slept there the one night and got wet in bed with the rain coming in, we took a taxi which was supposed to take us to the first town on the other side of the border, but instead it dumped us at the border. Fortunately, a student who was going to Guatemala City to college drove up and agreed to take us to that town. I think it was Malacatan, something like that. After registering, a young fellow rushed up to Mac and asked to see his passport. Mac asked him if he was from the Policia, but he wasn't. Anyway, we went outside then to take a look at the town and go see the Mexican consul, where we expected to get a new tourist card.
Well, did Mac show him his passport?
No, he wouldn't show it to him.
Right.
He didn't know what business he had or who he was. So, in the town was covered by posters saying Arbenz land reform, and they had a big hammer and sickle with blood, drops of blood dropping from it. This was all over the town, and everybody seemed to be talking in whispers. Anyway, we went in to see the consul, and he told us that we weren't considered tourists in Guatemala unless we stayed at least a week. Well, this was quite a shock because we didn't have enough money with us to stay a week. But at our hotel afterwards, when we returned, we met this young American who was married to a Spanish-Moroccan woman, and he was having trouble getting her into Mexico because Mexico didn't recognize Franco Spain, which owned Morocco at that time. And they didn't recognize them, and it was difficult to get anybody from Morocco into the country. But he told us he had been up to a town, up the next town up was much, much cheaper, and that we could probably live there the whole week.
All right. On the money you had.
Yes, on the money we had. So, at lunchtime, two American cars drove up, and Max said, well, I got the ride for us at the border, now it's your turn. So I went over to the table and found out one of the cars was driven by a Protestant missionary who was returning to the lake in Guatemala, a lake not too far away, and the other was an American colonel and his wife, and they were going to Colombia. At that time, in Colombia, he was an advisor, he said, an American military advisor to the government in Colombia, which at that time was bombing the peasants with napalm. Anyway, I asked them about the ride. We had found out that the only bus going to that town, or the next bus, was going to go at 1 o'clock at night, which was a very inconvenient time to go. So...
anyway, I asked them if they were going on to that next town the next morning, and they said yes, and so I asked if we could go with them. Well, the colonel, maybe he had a bigger title, I really don't remember, but anyway, he said that there was such a steep mountain that he thought it would be too much weight in the car for him to take it. So we arranged that we would go with the missionary, and he and his wife would take the luggage. She wouldn't even talk to me. You know, she would ask him what I said, although I was right there, and carry on this conversation as if it were a foreign language or something. That's because, you know, I had asked him for a ride, I guess. Anyway, so the next morning we started out. We were stopped by the army, who were mostly in their bare feet, it seemed, every couple of miles. So I asked the Protestant missionary why we were being stopped, and he said, oh, because the new government, Armas, was worried that Arbenz was, who had been thrown out. I think I'll go in a little bit of the history here. Arbenz was the second elected president. There was one before him who was very good, and then he came along and was a very mild liberal who wanted to have a little land reform for the peasants. Now, the country of Guatemala was owned practically lock, stock, and barrel by United Fruit Company. Yes. They owned the railroad going across the country. They owned an awful lot of the land. And he wanted to arrange, I think he was even, the government would pay to United Fruit for some of the unused land, land that wasn't used at all, to give to the penniless Indians.
In agrarian reform.
Yes. And, but the CIA from Honduras arranged an army of exiles, they were Guatemalans that were living in various parts of the world. They assembled them and trained them in Honduras and had them come in with planes first and bomb Guatemala City and distribute leaflets and terrify the people. Anyway, they took over and put in this military man called Armas. And ever since then, there's been, the military has run Guatemala, and thousands of people have been killed. Anyway, to get back to the story of getting up to the next town was called San Carlos. So, we finally made it up there, and who shows up, comes running out of the hotel, was this little character that had asked my husband to show his passport again. I don't know how he got up there. Anyway, this town was just the same, covered with posters and everybody talking in whispers. We went to a little tiny bar that night. It was just like a little simple house that had raw rum, and we sat over in one place with, and since we could speak Spanish we had been living in Mexico. Somebody at the table began talking to us about the Korean War, and a couple of men came in the door and sat at a table and kept on moving over till they were at the table right next to us. Anyway, we got out of there pretty soon. And then the papers the next day were full of headlines about the trouble that Guatemala was having with England, because England for years that Guatemala had claimed British Honduras. So my husband, since he was English, he had an English passport. And the paper said that any Englishmen in the country were going to be arrested. So Max said, oh my, we'll get out of this place and get back, and I'm going to tell the Mexican consul that he either gives us a tourist card to get out of the country right away, or he puts us up for the week that we're supposed to be here.
So we started, we got bus tickets for the next morning, and we got in the bus. I think Guatemala must buy the second class buses that are all torn apart and that use them in Guatemala, because these didn't have any seats, just benches, and there were chickens and animals underneath us, and it was just jam full. But the last minute, this little character jumps on the bus. Anyway, we start out going from town to town, and how he made room behind us, squeezed in, he would get out at every town and wander around and come back, and then we reached a town where a family was going to get off, but the driver wouldn't give them their luggage, which was on top of the bus. Their luggage consisted of, a sack of something. Yes, a sack of something. And so Max spoke up and said, well, how much did they owe? I'll pay the quesos, or whatever it was in Guatemala. I think it's quetzal.
Mm-hmm.
Quetzal. And this little character behind said, you have nothing to do with this. It's none of your business. Anyway, the driver did let them out. And everybody on the bus then, you could tell, was very friendly with us. They didn't mind it off little person. Yes. Well, you could tell they knew who this person was, too. So then later on, he, instead of asking me the time, he grabbed my wrist, and my husband gave him a swat, when he wanted to know the time. And so anyway, in these little towns, the poverty you can't imagine. I should have said we went to a little town. We had walked to a little town close by this place where the people were really dressed very colorfully. These were the better off Indians. They made their own clothes. Then at the same time, you would see, and everybody talking in whispers, you would see people coming by with their clothes just made out of rags sewed together. And they would carry what looked like a bookcase on their back with a little bit of pottery and all their worldly belongings. Now, these people were looking for jobs on coffee thinkers. In fact, the couple, the family that was getting off and was having trouble getting off because of not having enough money, were getting off at a coffee thinker to pick the coffee. Anyway, we got back to our place in Malacatan, went to see the consul. Mac told him his story, and the consul decided to give us tourist cards if we promised to go out a different entrance than we had come in. Now, I don't know just why that was, but anyway. So it was pouring rain as usual. It was a Saturday afternoon, and we took a cab down to this other place, this other little town, and they had to check up our names there. Getting out, we had to pay a mordida because it was Saturday afternoon, and a mordida to get into Mexico, and we had to walk across this bridge which had train tracks on them. It was really a railroad trestle in the pouring rain, and carrying our luggage, it was really a mess. But we were so glad to get out of that country, I can't tell you, that we just breathed a sigh of relief when we got back to Mexico, and the bus was very cheerful in Mexico. We came to a place where the rain had washed out a bridge, and everybody gets out of the bus to help fix it. A woman there said she had friends meeting her on the other side. I guess the bridge was good. It was the entrance to the bridge that was washed out.
Uh-huh.
But anyway, we were able to walk across the bridge, and she had friends, and she agreed, they took us on to the next town where we could take a bus. Anyway, that's the story of Guatemala, and things are still like that bad.
Yeah, that's very interesting.
Now we'll be back to the second house.
Well, I think I told you before, as soon as we got in there, I read in the paper that they were going to put a new highway going all around the town that would take away this house. That's why we had gotten it at such a good price. It was across from a beautiful park.
Now, this was the first house.
This is the second house.
Oh, this is the second
house. Well, that I was just entering before. We would start our business again. Well, when we found that out, we couldn't be too enthusiastic about the building. And next door, they didn't seem to know that that house was going to be taken down. We figured it was going to be taken down in between, because they were working all the time, putting a new facing of stone on the building, which made it look beautiful. But the dust from that place swerved into our place all the time. The way the houses are built there is a little different. There's a patio in the middle. That's sort of open.
Yeah.
So from one place to the other, the dust came down. We knew we couldn't be there very long. Anyway, we stayed. We were there about 6 months, and we had a sale and sold most of the things off and put the rest of some pieces of furniture up in one of the little houses we had in Las Fuentes. And so we moved back to Las Fuentes then. And then we thought we would buy a house in Puerto Vallarta, which we did. But it wasn't on the water, and we went down there for 6 months, rented our house in Las Fuentes. But our wonderful dog died there. That's one of the two. Died there, and Puerto Vallarta is wonderful for a vacation, but for living, it just didn't seem to work out. So when the people we had rented the house to told us that they had been in a bad accident, and the woman, who happened to be Mrs. McDonald, the wife of the, you know, the McDonald hamburger place.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
The man was a singer, the man with the golden voice, he called himself. Anyway, he showed us clippings. Well, that was her friend.
Her friend, pardon me.
Anyway, anyway, they had been in a terrible accident, and she had broken her neck, so they were very glad to be released from the lease they had.
How old was
she? She was probably about 70.
Oh, she was at the end.
Yes. He was a little younger, but he wasn't a spring chicken or anything.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So anyway, they were glad to be released and go. She wanted to get back to the States and get proper care. She was recovering at our place, and the donkey we had at Las Fuentes used to keep her awake. So. Then we
moved back there then?
Yes, we moved back to the Las Fuentes house. And then in a month or two, Max saw a beautiful house he had been watching almost across the street from the first place where we had had our business so long,
mm-hmm.
and where it had been so successful. So we went to see them, and we rented that and started over again.
And go out and buy new furniture.
Yes, well, we had stored some up in Las Fuentes, so we had some to start with, and we knew the ropes, I knew the places to get furniture, and people that went to little towns getting furniture, and this was a large house, but it wasn't as large as the other house.
Mm-hmm.
So we decided we would have a smaller business there. And we didn't hire carpenters. We had had two or three carpenters all the time in the other place. Who stripped furniture and refinished it. Is that moving? And we also had people that did retaining for us. We sold hundreds and hundreds of pieces of Austrian bentwood. It seemed that all the middle class in Mexico at the end of the 19th century had bought their furniture from Europe or the United States. They bought Grand Rapids furniture.
Yeah.
That's the oak, which became very popular.
Yeah.
I would say while we had our store, we probably sold at least 100 roll-top desks made in the United States and roperos.
But where would you buy these?
Well, we had put ads in the paper, you see, and we would get
up to 15 or 20 calls a day of people that were moving from the old houses near the center of town and moving out, and they wanted new shiny furniture, and they wanted to get rid of their old things.
Mm-hmm.
So I spent the day looking at furniture and buying furniture, and Max spent the day selling furniture.
So that's how you learned your business, like going out and observing.
And then I traveled around a little and learned how they learned a stain that was very easy to do, and how to strip furniture of oak and pine, particularly with caustic soda. It's very easy, and with a hose, you wash it off. You can do an awful lot of pieces of furniture in a day. They come out clean. You sand them, and then we put on this chapapote and would wax that when it got later. You could make it as a light brown as you wanted or dark brown.
Mm-hmm.
But we also used French polish, which is shellac, and a varnish, I mean, depending on the furniture. So I worked with the carpenters quite a lot when I wasn't out looking at furniture.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And
that's how you learned to do all of it.
Yeah. Yeah. So in this second house, our carpenters already, one had settled in his own business, and the other one had a job someplace else. So we decided we'd get along doing our own carpentry. Loopy, who had worked for us before, and she did selling and gold leafing and a little bit of everything. So she and I did a lot of the refinishing, but if we had special big jobs that we couldn't handle, we could send them out to renew people, carpenters,
mm-hmm.
who did this kind of work.
Mm-hmm.
So we would send some pieces out, and we carried on the business in a much smaller way until my husband died suddenly in 1979. And then I had a sister, Mary, living in Montevideo. She had an apartment. Her husband had died just when the two of them were ready to move into this apartment they had ordered the year before. And she had this two-bedroom apartment over the ocean. And I cleaned up my business in Guadalajara. I put most of the best furniture we had on consignment with other antique stores, and then sold and gave away things, and sold the property in Las Fuentes, and cleaned up on all those things. It took me only about a month to do that, and Mary stayed with me quite a bit of that time to keep me company and help, and so then I went down to live with her for a while. I needed a rest after getting rid of all this furniture. And, you know, I also had some furnished apartments, got rid of everything though. Then, so I stayed with her, and it was very peaceful, which was fine for a while, but then I began getting a little bored. But in April, we went to Cuba for 2 weeks. And that was an interesting trip, because we landed by this little plane from Florida. We met in Florida because she visited a relative of her husband, the husband's brother's wife, in Georgia. Anyway, we met in Miami, which I didn't care for very much, and flew down to Cuba. And we were there over May 1st, so we heard Castro speak. There were a million people there that day, or more. We heard Bishop from Grenada speak, and of course he was brought up speaking English, so everybody, we could understand him. We had walked our tour. Our tour was an economic tour, and we stayed in the old part of Havana, which was particularly interesting to both Mary and me, because we had been to Havana before. I had been there just, you know, a day or so, a day and a night.
Ship stop.
Where the ship stopped, and she had been there. And we stayed in this nice hotel, which was a little bit run down, but it still had the old kind of antique furniture that we had had in our stores in Guadalajara. And we went through a psychiatric hospital there, which was very impressive, because, well, they had pictures of what that was like when Castro took over. And, I mean, people were lying on the floor, just terrible condition. And now they had them with separate rooms, and in the daytime they all did useful work. They didn't do work just for the sake of doing work. The ones that were the sickest and the worst off mentally were the ones that had been in the hospital when they took over from Batista. Because if you've been mentally sick for a long, long time, it's harder to get you out of it. But they had arrangements so that when people came in, they gave them work to do, and after a certain time, most of them were ready to go back to their families. But the family was given extra money to take care of the person, and the family was trained on how to take care of them, too. And anyway, we saw these people working, and you know, some of them would be packing things away, and then they'd stop for a little while, and their hands might shake or something, and then they'd go forward with the work. But they were all doing things that had to be done. And then we flew to Santiago on the other end of the peninsula and drove back so that we had a good view of the whole town. We saw where the Moncada uprising was when they were not successful the first time, Castro and his group. This building was still full of holes. It was a, you know, a museum now. Yeah. And they were having trouble with two diseases that year. One was a disease that the pigs had. And this Santiago was right next to Guantanamo. Anyway, they always suspected that these germs may have been introduced by the CIA.
That's a euphemism.
Yeah. It was both on the sugar cane. I don't think it was the sugar cane, but anyway, it was the pig disease. And the other was something on the cotton, that's right. Because when we left Santiago several times, we had to walk through puddles that had some disinfectant. It seems that the germs are carried on your shoes a lot. If you had any other shoes packed up, you had to take them out and put them in the puddle and get them in it. And then we stopped at a ranch where they're doing very well. Well, in the country, it's really, most of Cuba it's geographically, it isn't too beautiful, except the mountains were beautiful where they are. But you drive along this flat country where there's sugar cane or where the land is lying fallow to be used the next year, and you will suddenly see it looks like a city is coming up, because there will be apartments of several floors, apartment buildings. Mm-hmm. And what they are, these are collective farms. Mm-hmm. The people before that, most of the peasantry, lived in these little, bohios, I think they call them in Cuba, and where they didn't have running water, I mean, very primitive little shacks. Mm-hmm. Made with a straw roof and made of adobe, it seems to me they were. And but they were told if they put their, some of the farms, they could keep their little house and keep their little farm if they wanted to, if they had any, a little bit of land. Mm-hmm. Or they could bring their tools and their animals and join the collective. They'd be given an apartment furnished with everything. We went into one of the apartments, and they had gas stoves and electric refrigerators and running water. And it seems if the
toilets.
Yes, and if the head of the family died, the apartment would go to the wife or the oldest child and so forth. So people had a choice. And all over Cuba, in the country, you run across these villages. There'll be schools there, market there, you know, everything that's needed will be out in this country area.
Yes.
Then we